This podcast is supported by Podcast Labs, Bournemouth's full-service podcast production and marketing agency.
Hello, welcome to The Tenth Degree. I'm Anthony Story. It's so hard to pin down if what you're doing is actually right. It's something Adrian Dwyer knows only too well. He took his business to the absolute brink, only for it to latch on brilliantly and eventually sell for a really healthy return. He's run the gauntlet several times, and he shares insights and examples about how he and other people have done it. Around getting your product right, about intellectual property, IP, pivoting again, and generally just staying one step ahead. It's a bit of a roller coaster, but please, jump on board. Dare I say it's a five-star review-worthy episode? So I'm here today with Adrian Dwyer. Adrian is a consultant with a broad brief of experience. You've been a director, a non-exec director with a range of different companies. You've worked extensively with technology, most recently employing deep learning, AI and communications, developing autonomous vehicles over the past 6 years.
That's correct.
Okay. So, rather than concentrate on specific business, though, your core focus is based on kind of a much broader reach within companies. So that's included identifying business opportunities, analyzing and evaluating markets, initiating new ideas, and adapting commercial propositions to fit the requirements. Does that sound kind of about the right area for you?
I think that sums it up very well.
Okay, excellent. So, but let's kind of dive into that in a moment. Before we do, let's kind of go back a little bit. And I was really interested by the fact that you studied yacht and boat design.
I studied yacht and boat design, yes. I worked for a number of the top yacht designers for a while. I was really lucky because it was a time when, if you're old enough to remember the 386 computer and the 486 computer, and it was a time when, for the very first time ever, we were able to define a yacht's hull by a 486 computer. And whereas an naval architect would take literally weeks to design a hull, I would take probably a day, but where it really paid off was on things like the hydrostatics and the stability calculations that previously would just take weeks and weeks of work, and I could do it at a touch of a button. But what I learned from that was not that I was a particularly smart designer or whatever, but being able to show designers and show naval architects that technology in a way that didn't demean that their experience or whatever. So it was a good grounding for being able to introduce new technologies to different marketplaces, really.
So you came out of university straight, I suppose, with a kind of high level of innovation from the get-go, really. It's not like you followed into a particularly pre-drawn path. You've kind of innovated from the start.
Yeah, well, it was just exactly at the time when they were bringing in new computing to yacht design, and that was my passion, my sport, but it's also my passion. But it absolutely revolutionized yacht design and naval architecture. So in that respect, I was in the right place at the right time. I was the first person in the UK to do full-size lofting of hulls using a PC computer, which previously not only would take large amounts of space in a boatyard, but would take, again, you know, weeks of time for people to do, and I was able to do that from a computer using printers, you know, large printers to print out the hull, not quite full size, but large enough that they could then manufacture the hull straight away. So taking weeks and weeks off the development time.
Oh wow! So what's lofting?
Lofting is taking yacht designers work on a drawing boards that's a nought in size, and you need to build a boat that's 40, 50, 60, 70 foot long or whatever. So the business of scaling up that drawing, basically they draw out the whole hull on a very flat floor, using some very sort of traditional skills, but to make sure that all the curves, if you like, are perfectly formed. From the A-naught drawing, the scale down drawing, that's what lofting is. And from that, you then can manufacture the frames and the bulkheads in order that you can then go make the hull.
Which is probably also a really good discipline for we work in a digital creative tech industry, but actually that commitment to planning up front, that's really strong and can be alien for quite a few people working in our sector.
I completely agree. When you're introducing a technology that revolutionizes somebody's career, somebody's business, there could be a tendency for them to just look the other way and pretend it's not happening. But actually showing them that it's a tool that they can use with their experience and knowledge, something that I didn't have as a young designer, that it was just a tool for them, yeah, got us from being an interesting idea to actually selling some and actually making some money.
And presumably that sort of stands you in good stead, particularly for the work that you do when you're going into companies and giving them some help and advice, is that grounding in, you know, some of the basics up front, which presumably quite a lot, you know, the reason people need you is they haven't always thought of those things to begin with.
I think very often people are very focused on what they do and what they're good at. And sometimes, you know, somebody like myself, an external consultant, can come in and say, well, actually, how about looking at it from a different angle? Or have you thought about this? And some of those questions, some of the answers will be very obvious, but some of them, you know, will cause people to go away and think about things. And hopefully we'll come back then with a more robust proposition.
Do you have a particular, so when you're going and you're helping somebody in terms of developing vision, developing their strategy, do you have a particular approach that you have when you start off with that, or do you just kind of respond to what's being presented to you?
I think there are two big things, really. One is, you know, fundamentally listening, understanding, and the second thing is just understanding their business and what that proposition is to a high level of detail. So I will take, you know, quite a lot of time talking to people, talking to the inventors or to the people running the thing. Yeah, really getting a deep understanding of what it is they can actually do. What is it that's good in their business, and what is it they're doing that somebody else isn't doing? And I think once you sort of understand those sort of fundamentals, then you know, is that company in the best position to deliver that? Is it the right market they're in? Could there be a different market? Have they got the right set of skills internally? Have they got a fully baked management team, for example, with all the skills they need? But if you really understand the underlying technology and what it does, then that gives you the basis on, you know, in order to be able to identify those things. And it comes back down to, you know, I often come across, you know, people in universities or colleges who've got some fantastic ideas, but they don't have much experience, you know, in the commercial world and much experience, you know, beyond that level of detail. So I come along and say, well, actually, you know, maybe you could use that technology for something else, and maybe that something else is a market that's easier to access or a market that's perhaps growing quicker. And if it's growing quicker, it might be easier for an early stage company to get traction. So it's asking those sort of questions and then being able to apply really experience, some good experiences and some mistakes I've made. And, you know, I very much hope that, you know, some of these companies don't make the mistakes that I've made.
I think one of the things we're really keen to try and do is to help in terms of providing some insights into what people might be able to do for themselves. So when you come along to a company for the first time, do you find that there are, I suppose, consistent failings that people do? There are certain steps that the majority of people haven't really thought through in depth, which just thinking through those things now might make a big difference.
I think the standout thing for me would be that they probably underestimate how difficult it is going from no revenue to a decent level of revenue. You know, that traction, that revenue traction is I think it pretty consistently is sort of people think it's going to be easier than it actually is. So that's why I like to look at, you know, what is the market? You know, what is the lowest fruit in that market? It might not necessarily be the one that the inventor or the person who's passionate about that technology is identified. But I think, you know, getting sales, getting revenue in the first instance is really tough. And I think that's one thing that people probably think is going to be easier than it actually is.
And in terms of going about trying to get those sales, what is it that people aren't doing, which they ought to be doing more of?
I think the one thing I'd suggest is just sort of stepping back before really putting the pedal to the metal. And making sure that the market that you think you're going to is the lowest fruit. I know when I was one of the companies I founded, we thought we were in one particular sector, and somebody, a very experienced person, said to me, "What's the growth rate of that particular market?" And I knew the answer. I said, yeah, it's 4%, 5%, 6%. Some areas are going 10%. Some of these sectors of that market are growing as much as 10%. And I saw in his face, not quite disinterest, but certainly it wasn't excitement. And he said, well, take a step back and have a look at the other markets. And that's exactly what we did. You know, went back home, got on Google, had a look around, and we found a market in which the laggards were doing sort of 40% year-on-year growth. And literally that night we turned from one market to another. And in that particular instance, you know, the rest is history, because we were in a marketplace where everybody was receptive. It was a much richer market. And as I say, the fact that it was growing at such a rate just enabled us to get that initial traction.
So the secret isn't always about how good the product is. The secret is as much to do with where is that product going to be sold, who's interested in buying that in the first place, and trying to look around and think broadly in terms of where you might be able to find a home for your product to go.
I completely agree. Yeah, I completely agree. And, you know, I've come across, for example, ideas in the products in the medical devices market. And part of the advice has been to actually step back and deliver a lower, let's call it a lower grade or a device with lower intellectual property as a first stage and get some traction in terms of revenues, but also make some progress in terms of things like regulatory affairs. And you can use that then as a stepping stone to, you know, the next product or the next iteration of it. But by then you've got some revenue traction and you've got, you know, a basis from which to build.
Mm-hmm. We hear a lot about the TAM, SAM and SOM, the total addressable market, the serviceable addressable market, the serviceable obtainable market. How do you go about trying to determine sort of in terms of, well, what really constitutes the things which fit into those categories? So for instance, I mean, you see people go, well, I'm building an app, therefore my total addressable market is everybody in the world. How do you try and scale in and focus on really what that is?
Well, I think often when I come across people, they actually know the answers to some of those questions and know where to find them. And probably they do so, you know, better than perhaps I do. But it's rationalising that and actually coming up with a metric that convert that, you know, addressable market down to a market that I can actually address and I can actually sell into. So I don't think there's rocket science there at all. I don't think it's beyond the wit of man to do that. But I think the exercise of that rational exercise of doing that is a very healthy thing to do. And I think it gives you a far better idea of what is the easiest market, what is that addressable market for the particular product or proposition that I have.
And have you kind of got, and I suppose you gave the example earlier on where you completely refocused one of the products that you were working on to focus something else. In terms of some of the companies who you're working with, can you think of any examples where, you know, you've been able to help people to slightly more broaden their market, broaden their focus? Or is it actually the opposite? Is it more about really targeting your focus so you're getting at people that really want to work with you?
Well, I think there's a range of examples, but that's one I'll give you, which is that I was asked to review what I was told to be a wave barrier. So something that sits in the sea and reduces wave height, so reduces erosion and good things like that. And they'd received some early stage funding, some grant funding, very bright guys. And I looked at it and said to them, well, so what have you done in terms of marketing, you know, and how many leads have you got and how has that converted into sales? And they'd done quite a bit of marketing, got almost zero leads and certainly hadn't got any sales. So things were coming to an end. It was such a simple idea that their patents, the second stage of their patents were coming up within 6 months. So basically they either had to raise £50,000 to pay the next stage of the patent process, or really they had nothing because it was so simple that any without the patents, anybody could go off and do it. So I spent some time looking at the technology and their claims, and I was a bit dubious about their claims, and we started to drill down. And what I actually found was that they were measuring the attenuation, the reduction in the wave height through an actuator, and the actuator was then generating some electricity. And I said, hang on a minute, guys, so where's that? What's happening to that electricity? And they just very flippantly said, oh, well, we just burn it off on a resistor. And I stood back just looked and said, hey guys, you know, this is not a wave barrier. This is a wave energy device, you know, wave energy, lots of investment money going into wave energy. Everybody wants wave energy to be a solution to, you know, renewable energy. It ticks absolutely all the boxes. And I managed to get them a £400,000 grant literally within weeks of the next stage of the Manhattan process. So that was a case of where they had some bright ideas. The market they were addressing was one they're familiar with. We challenged that in terms of what the market was doing. And guess what? You know, it's a really excellent proposition, the wave energy marketplace. And we got the funding to get the next stage of the patent process and to get to the next stage of the development of the product. So, you know, it's a good example of looking at technology and saying, well, actually, it may not be the market you think it could be applied for. It could be something else.
Have you found so that in some of the experience you've had working with companies that you get real resistance to trying to get into that change? Do people kind of very wedded in terms of what their focus is?
I think that if you've got a good cohesive argument, then it becomes obvious. And certainly it did in that particular instance, that, you know, there's no question, you know, I think that probably they were looking at the ultimate customer who would pay the money, whereas I was looking at what's the next stage in the company development. And it was about raising funding in order to do a prototype. And then the prototype would need, you'd need funding to do a first product, etc. So actually the targets were funders, but funders were interested because there's a lot of money going into wave energy. So you know, it was a cohesive argument, and actually, you know, the penny dropped. They were very happy very happy that they got the next stage of the patent process paid for, basically.
One thing that strikes me is that a lot of people who set up businesses quite often come from a non-business background. So there are people who set their business up because they've got very clear ideas in terms of creating strong creativity, or sort of more technical backgrounds, and they're interested in creating seamless customer journeys. Or there are just people who are fed up with being told what to do when they think that the people telling them what to do don't know as much as they do. And we've probably all been guilty of that.
Quite a few people in there who would tick that box. Yeah.
But I was just wondering. So in terms of trying to think, because what that ends up doing can be to, I suppose, be very focused on wedded on your product, wedded on your process, wedded on the things that you create, the outputs that you have. So you have fantastically good products, but not necessarily good sales, or not necessarily a good business strategy, or not even necessarily a good business. Is that the sort of thing that you come across in your experience? And are there ways to think about, as a business leader, you could reframe the way that you look at your business?
I think there's always an opportunity to sort of relook at what you're doing and to sort of reanalyze what you're doing and making sure you know it is it is driving you towards the objectives that you want to get to. I had the company we were talking about earlier in autonomous vehicles started out as a very very smart set of algorithms in vehicle dynamics, and actually the guy was doing it as a hobby. What actually happened was a certain Formula One team came across it and said, actually, it's better than the technology we're using. Can we have it? And that was the start of the business. But vehicle dynamics is a very, very niche sector. You know, there's probably 200-300 vehicle dynamicists in this world. So your market is very limited. So I got the guy to sort of sit back a bit and say, well, what's a bigger market here? And how can you address that? And it turned out that with a fair amount of development work that he could come up with a proposition in the autonomous vehicle market, because that is a huge growing market at the moment. In that particular instance, the rest is history, because he sold the company for an awful lot of money in the end of June.
So how did that start, though? So basically, you've got somebody who's got a great bit of tech, believes in the tech. How do you go from that position of going, right, I've got this fantastic bit of tech, but what do I do with it? Where do I take this? How do I kind of turn this into being a proper business?
So that particular one was a long journey. You know, it was a 6-7 year journey from really what was some smart technology, but very very niche sector, and it was being it was about being a sort of constantly questioning: is this the right marketplace? Can we do better? Is there a better, faster market that we can access? And and where were we making our most money? So it turned out that there was a particular area of interest that the founder wasn't interested in that particular sector, part of it at all, but it turned out it made a very good margin. So he was able to focus on doing the sort of real high-end IP generation, but there was a cash cow. We identified a cash cow that started to pay the overheads and started to be able to pay the wages of developers who are developing the really smart stuff. But that was just by looking at the marketplace, seeing what it wanted, and could that be bolted onto to what we were doing? And now, you know, that was is a substantial cash cow to the business.
So you were saying that the kind of success has come from a direction which the founder wasn't necessarily looking into in the first place.
Oh, so definitely, definitely.
What's the importance of a strong team around you, and how do you go about trying to create that?
So I think if you have a clear idea of where you want to be ultimately, you know, the sort of 5-year plan, the sort of 10-year plan, and I was with a company yesterday and they had a very clear position where they want to be in 5 to 10 years, and basically it's to sell the company. So if you then sort of start to roll back from that, what is it that an acquirer wants to buy? What is it about your proposition that they want to buy? In that instance, there are a small number of very clever people, and so that would potentially would be a problem to an acquirer. So between now and the next 5 years, we need to develop a management team that you know, looks a fully baked, a fully cohesive management team, one that's got all the sort of relevant skills, so the potential acquirer can look at this business and say, great, I'll buy this business. It's not going to be terribly risky because they've already got all the skills they need, and I'm happy to pay a premium because they've got some very clever IP there. So that's a case of knowing where you want to be in the 5-10 year timescale, and looking back, and you know, what are the parameters that I need at 5 years? And you won't be able to necessarily, you won't be able to afford to have those in on day one, but it does give you a clear idea of what you need to do, you know, along that journey. And I come across instances where you can make certain decisions, you know, understanding where you want to be in 5 years or 10 years, understanding that could change the decisions that you make along the way. So I think that's, you know, a lot of people have a great idea of a great idea and think they're going to make, you know, loads of money straight away, but they don't necessarily think, you know, how they're going to build value. So there's building revenue, which is tricky, you know, getting that revenue traction. But there's also building value, and the two are very different things.
Mm. Does that work for the service companies as well? Have you kind of worked, because most of the examples you've got are product based, and a lot of the companies we work with are service based. So does that model work? Because a lot of service companies, I suppose, are built around the skills of the founders in the first place.
And so I would challenge that and say, you know, what is it that those founders can do that's expandable? You know, how can you expand the business from, you know, 1-man band to a 2-man band to a 10-man band? You know, what is it that you've got? How can you, what can you do with that experience and knowledge? How could you either productize it, or how can you deploy that in a way that's an expandable business? And I think that most businesses you can probably find a way through there. It's just you've got to have the mindset to question. How can we do that? So yeah, you're right. Most of the business I've worked with are product businesses, but I still think in the services business, it's how can we build value, not just how can we build the revenue.
I think that comes up, raises a really interesting point in terms of, do you want to create a business, or do you want to have a business through which you can express yourself, I suppose, for want of a better description, whether that's creatively, whether that's technically or whatever. But if you're motivation for the business is to do great work, then it's quite hard to divorce yourself from that. But are you suggesting that perhaps even it may not be you, but to go in with somebody else who does have that vision, for somebody who can keep focusing on what the business is about rather than about what it is that you can create?
I completely agree. And certainly with a creative business, it can come down to a very small number of people. You know, could it be even one person? So how can you build a business that looks like a team, not just looks like one person? You know, there's some challenges there, because often your client wants you. They don't want anybody else. So, you know, how can your proposition change over a period of time such that they become less dependent on you, or your revenues become less dependent on you? And it looks like a business that somebody could take over and still retain that customer, or still retain, you know, the service contract that you have with them. So those are the sort of things you look at in terms of trying to build value.
Well, I think that whole idea in terms of trying to look 5 years ahead and retrofit yourself backwards is a really interesting discipline, probably not one that people explore very deeply, particularly kind of in the examples we just talked about.
And to, you know, to be absolutely fair, to the sort of young inventor, the young entrepreneur, they probably haven't any experience of what it is to go and buy a company. You know, if you have to put yourself in the buyer's shoes, what would I be looking for in a company if I was going to buy it? And if it's just a one man band with some, you know, good clients, well, you would value the business on the clients, but then you would apply a heavy discount because it comes down to one person. You know that as soon as you hand over the check, they're going to be, you know, off down to the Med on a big yacht or something. So, you know, that's if you put yourself in the shoes of the acquirer, then it becomes a bit clearer about, you know, how the proposition that you have at that 5-year point in time.
Well, that's something that you also deal with, is trying to get people ready for that point when they can sell or when they can get investment. So I suppose presumably for most people, investment will come first.
Well, it depends. But if we take the exit first of all, I think it's a sort of 2 to 3 year process for most companies. It takes an awful lot of, you know, sorting out and getting the thing looking like it's ready for sale. That's not to say you couldn't sell a company before that, but it's a lot of people sort of concentrate on the big ticket value. But of course, actually, where the real work comes in is making sure that the deal that you get for selling the company is a good deal. So, you know, they're very much good deals and bad deals, but the better the your company, the more fully baked the proposition by the time you go to sell the company, the better the terms on which you're going to get. So then coming back to investments, I think the experience we had the other day was that there was a need for people to sort of understand the investment business or the why people invest and how they invest and what it is investors are looking for, as opposed to I've got a great idea, surely somebody's going to throw some money at it. Well, funny enough, most investors, you know, are awash with people wanting them to throw money at them, but it's you know, about what the money's for, how am I going to get my money back? You know, demonstrating that all of those sort of factors, you know, influences an investor as to whether they're going to invest. But it's also about looking at the type of investor, you know, what stage is the company and what stage of investor that you're looking at.
Well, let me come back to the investment in a moment. I don't want to quite leave the exit thing yet, because that's really interesting. So 2 years in terms of, so it's 2 years from when you first start thinking about, okay, I want to sell my company to the
likelihood of that
happening.
At least two years. Yeah.
And in terms of...
As an ideal situation, yeah. And the market's not getting... I don't think the market is generally not any easier. So, for example, I sold a company, I advised on the sale of a company that we sold in July. That was 2.5 years between accepting an offer and actually the signing of the deal.
So was the company ready 2.5 years before it sold to be sold? Or were the people planning in advance in expectation of the fact they would be in the position where they would be very sellable?
I tell you what they were. They're a company that knew that they perhaps wanted to sell at some point in time, and it, the sort of thing that they were going to get around to doing all the sort of housekeeping that you need to do. They were going to get around to that. And of course, never actually did. We then got a very good offer, but then when you go into due diligence, which is a real deep dive into the finances, a real deep dive into the legals, a real deep dive into, in this instance, some of the assets, a few issues started popping up. We had a couple of major issues, and those have to be resolved in a ideal scenario. And there's no company in this world that hasn't got some sort of, you know, hasn't had some sort of issue in the past, or, you know, some legacy stuff there, which doesn't worry me in the least. What you have to do is sort of ring fence that and reduce the risk for the acquirer. So I've, you know, come across some quite challenging situations, but you know, by looking at those rationally and ring fencing them, you know, they can be overcome to the point of somebody then paying a premium for the business. So, but those things take time, you know. And of course, these are sort of things that aren't necessarily they're not driving the revenue of the company. They're not driving the company forward. It's all stuff that and I'm as guilty as anybody else. It's stuff that I'm going to get around to one day. It's just one day never quite happens.
So if you have an expectation you aren't going to sell, it may be selling in 5 years, you know, 10 years or 7 years or whatever it may be, are there any sort of top tips of things that you ought to do to try and make that journey simpler when you finally get to the point of going, okay, I'm ready now?
Are there any top tips? I would certainly make sure that the financials are in good shape and can be rigorously analysed. So an investor will not just look at financials for one direction; they'll look at it for many directions. And so, having a set of finances that you can rigorously go through is key. In the digital world, making sure that your contracts are all as robust as possible, particularly if you're using subcontractors, you want to make sure that you own the IP, you own the code, and secondly that they don't own the code. I think there's sort of two things there. Those are sort of things that typically trip people up. If you're in a manufacturing business, then, or in a product business, things like work in progress, how you're valuing that, needs to be robust, because that's a typical area where somebody might disagree with you and on your assumptions there. So having something that can withstand a rigorous analysis, and that's where an accountant will help you. Mm-hmm. But those are a number of key things. And if there are issues, and as I say, every company has a skeleton or has an issue, either dealing with those or ring fencing them such that the acquirer sees them as a ring fenced issue, and that doesn't detract from the overall deal.
And presumably being honest about those up front is because the chance are they are going to be discovered at some point, and is it better to be up front about it?
It's totally better to be up front. Within the process, you will hopefully accept an offer. You'll accept, and then you'll go into accepting the detailed terms of an offer, and then at the final iteration, you'll be asked to sign a number of warranties, and the warranties will be extensive. Even for small companies, they will be extensive. And I think any lawyer will tell you, you have to have everything on the table at that point. And so long as the acquirer knows about those things, they can take a judgment on them. But if you sign a warranty and knowingly there's an issue and don't disclose it, you would be in a very difficult position thereafter. And frankly, it's just not worth the, you want to go be able to sleep at night. So, disclose everything. And generally in M&A, mergers and acquisitions, there is an expectation that every company has got a few issues, and so it's no big deal. Obviously, it depends on the issue itself, but they're not expecting an absolutely perfect company, because there's no such thing.
Okay, and then I suppose one of the ways to get to the exit is by having some money to get you there, and obviously, if you get an investor, they're very interested in the exit, because that's generally how they're going to get their money back. So is there kind of similarity with getting investment in the first place, or do you think there's kind of very different sort of sense of expectations you've got to create in the first place?
I think the thing I come across most is people who've got some great ideas and think that people investors will purely back a good idea. They've got less knowledge or are not able to set the expectations in terms of how that idea and the value of that idea will be realized ultimately. So from an investor, as you say, most investors will want to know what is the money being used for, and how is that driving the business forward. Is it making a quantum difference to the business or not? But then ultimately, how am I going to get my money out? It's not just about, they won't be terribly interested in simply taking dividends or simply getting paid a part of the profits. They're interested in a much bigger multiple of their investment than that. So ultimately, that'll mean an exit, some sort of corporate event. So it could be a pure sale of the company, or it could be what we call a secondary exit. So it could be an initial investor will invest to get to the company to a certain stage, knowing that they will then be another bigger investor coming in with more money at that next stage. But having a clear idea of what that is pretty important. But again, the fundamentals are there. How does the investor get their money out, and how? What are the metrics behind their lump of money going in? How does that fundamentally change the business? Mm. So I've seen people come to me and say, "Yeah, we want a load of investment, and I'm going to invest it in production or areas of the business." But it's not then obvious how you're going to increment the value of the company. If you're going to invent the next best thing and that becomes valuable, then that would work. Or if you're going to invest in sales and marketing, because you've been in a sort of pre-sales and marketing mode, as a company, and now you want to invest in exploiting that IP and by increased revenues, you know, I get that. That would increase the value of the company. So, you know, those are the sort of things that an investor is going to be looking for.
So I think we should probably wrap up at the moment, but I was thinking just in terms of one other aspect. I think the investment's really, really interesting, and I've just remembered we've done a podcast on investment, so I'm going to do something on that so we can get that one out there as well, because it's a very interesting area in terms of how you go about trying to get that money in the first place. But I just wanted to touch on one last thing that kind of particularly aligned with what you do in terms of mentoring and how you start to, I guess, develop the relationships that you have where mentoring can be really valuable. What is it that people benefit from mainly through having a mentoring experience?
Good question. I think it's a number of different things. It's having a sounding board. It's having somebody who they can trust and they can say, well, I'm about to employ this person, or I'm thinking about developing the business in this area, or I've got a product here, and having somebody who can sort of rigorously question them and rigorously analyze that. So having somebody that they can share those thoughts with, you know, who understands about commercializing, you know, how you might actually get revenues from that and how you grow those revenues. I think in the longer term, it's then having the guidance as to what you need to do. You know, what is a fully baked business? What is a fully baked senior management team, for example? What does that look like? You know, what skills do we need to plug in? You know, a company I visited recently, I think the CEO thinks he can do everything really well. And for the first 4 or 5 years of the business, you know, he has done a really good job. But when we looked at the 5-year plan and said, actually, you know, we want to increase the revenue substantially, well, that's not going to happen by him involved in sales, him involved in production, him involved in finance. And I think there's been a sort of slow realization that he's actually got to accept that to bring other people into the business and to trust those people. Because if he doesn't, that he's not building value. He's just, you know, treading water, incrementing the revenues a bit, but he's not really adding value. He could actually double the revenues of that particular business, the revenues, but I'm not convinced that it would have much impact on the value. And it's separating those two out that I think, you know, hopefully the penny with that guy is dropping, and that you know, he needs to have a management team, because that's something that somebody would buy, whereas they're not going to just buy him.
And how much do you find in terms of that trying to get someone to take on board those ideas, that your role as a mentor is there to provide advice, or is it as much to help people to discover the answers for themselves?
That's a good question. I think most of the people I work with probably know the answers themselves, or 80% of the answers themselves, but sometimes need some teasing out of those answers in order to then have a strategy sort of going forward. And there are exceptions, you know, some of the legal matters, some of the financial matters perhaps, but you know, I think they have a very good knowledge and of their overall business, but sometimes it just takes a bit of more focus you know, to develop that business.
And have you had mentors yourself in the past?
Yes, have, and that's been a mixed bag, to be honest. Yeah, you know, I've had one or two people that I would say transformed, you know, there's one particular person who said one thing that completely and utterly transformed our business and took it from something that was nearly about to flop to something that eventually, you know, we sold. So yeah, getting the right people, and there's a chemistry there. It's, you know, it's got to work from a chemistry point of view, because otherwise it just doesn't work. And I would certainly encourage people to work with the people that they like working with. And if there are sort of issues with chemistry with people, then move on. And a mistake I made early on was trying to work with somebody who clearly I was never ever going to work with. And you know, I now lament that with, you know, frustration. And what I should have done was just cut a deal and moved on. It would have been painful, but it would have been a, you know, searing of the boil, and then able to move on. As it was a constant drag, and I would never want to go through that again. But that's, you know, that's experience, isn't it? That's business.
Yeah. Adrian, I could keep going on with this for ages, but we probably should stop there. So thank you so much for that. That's been really interesting.
My pleasure.
And well, let's do it again another time, and we can pick up on a new part.
Fantastic. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Cheers.
I hope you enjoyed the episode. There's more information about all of our guests and all the topics they talk about at 10thdegree.co.uk. And also, please do review us. we really want to share the lessons and the advice that's given as widely as possible, and this really helps us to get that message out there. Thanks.